Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Gay Mormon Stories. I am your host today, Kevin Klusterman. Grateful to be with you. It's an exciting time to be involved in LGBT equality. I'm really pleased to have David Baker with us, who is on the line. And David, we're really happy to have you here with Gay Mormon Stories. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be here.
Now, David, you're a gay man, and you are also an active, devout, faithful Mormon, member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Is that right?
Absolutely, that's correct.
Great. So we're really grateful to have you on the program and looking forward to hearing your perspective and your story. Now, currently, you are working for Google. Is that right?
Yep. I work for Google as a political consultant, political strategist for them. They loan me out to campaigns and to outside groups to help them use technology better in elections.
So they loan you out, but they expect you to come back at some point.
Well, so they don't loan me out as a member of the campaign itself. They loan my skills out. I work as a sort of a consultant for all campaigns or all candidates on one side of the aisle or the other. They've got a couple of teams that sort of work on everything there.
Okay. Well, that's got to be pretty exciting.
It definitely is exciting and very, very busy and time-consuming during the election year. But it definitely was enjoyable. I loved it. It was fantastic and fun. And I mean, it's what I studied for in college. I studied as a political science major at the University of Utah and graduated there, wrote my thesis on the use of technology in elections. And I really, really enjoy that space.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a love for political science and politics to go into the business. So it must be great to have a job that is central with that.
Yeah, it really is. I saw a flowchart once that sort of defined success as doing something that you love, something that you're good at, and something that pays you well. And I sort of found that and really love the place that I'm at. I feel like I've gotten a good modicum of success in my job.
That's great. Well, David, let's kind of go back in time and tell us a little bit about your early life and maybe just a little bit about your family background to give us some context and begin your story here.
Yeah, absolutely. I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and I grew up in the church all throughout the Intermountain West, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, but grew up mostly in Salt Lake, up on the East Bench by the Hobo Zoo, and grew up there in a good, strong LDS family. My dad and his family all come from good pioneer stock, and my mom was a convert to the church, actually. She converted to the church when she was, I think, about 17 or 18, in Salt Lake. She was going to West High School, and some of her friends started bringing her to seminary, and she started taking the missionary discussions without her parents knowing, and then she ended up joining the church. So sort of a good blend of pioneer stock and my mom as a convert. Growing up made for a little bit more of a holistic experience as opposed to one or the other.
Sure. So your mom was not a member of the church, but she lived in Salt Lake City.
Correct. Her father, my grandpa, had grown up in the church, but considers himself a Jack Mormon and has been inactive her whole entire life. And her mom was Presbyterian, but he got a job working at a Hill Air Force Base in Ogden.
Okay.
So he was with the Air Force, they moved him to Hill, and he just sort of stayed there, and she grew up in Salt Lake.
And how did your parents meet?
My dad was going to his brother's wedding, and my mom was going to her best friend's wedding, and they were getting married to each other. And so they met, I think they met at the wedding, and then on the car ride down, my grandpa, my dad's father, decided to, he rearranged the car so that they would be in the same car coming back down together. So they met, had a good, nice, like, 6 hours of conversation in their first meeting and sort of started dating from there and got married.
Wow, that's fantastic. So what comes next in their story, and how do you come in?
Well, in their story, they then moved around a little bit. My dad is a mining engineer by trade, and so was going to school for a little bit, doing some other things, and working at a couple of jobs. But they moved around a bit and had my three older siblings, two brothers and a sister. And then about 5 years later, I was born in Arizona.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1989.
Okay.
So I actually just turned 24 last week.
Oh, so you're a young pup here.
That's what people tell me. People tell me I'm a young pup with an old soul. And I don't know how I feel about that. I almost prefer to be an old pup with a young soul like Hilda Perry.
Nice. I like that. Okay, so you're the youngest in the family. What's that like for you?
It definitely is interesting because I'm not only the youngest, but I also am the youngest by a good spread of 5 years between me and my youngest sibling.
So there was a little bit of a gap there, huh?
Yep, and so when she went off to college, I became an only child, essentially.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And that all sort of happened coalesced around the same time as my mom and dad getting divorced after 22 and a half years of marriage.
Oh, okay.
So after my parents got divorced, my mom started dating some other people afterwards and found my stepdad, and they ended up getting married, and we moved down to Texas. And so it was just me, my mom, and my stepdad, and the three of us lived down in Texas, and I really got to have the experience as an only child for about 3 years in my teenage years.
So you ended up moving to Texas with your mother and your stepfather, and obviously that must have been a big change for you from Utah.
Things are different in Texas. It's a very interesting state. I love it, but it's very, very interesting.
Is it true, David, that you should not mess with Texas?
Oh, you definitely should not mess with Texas. And the only thing you'd mess with in Texas is making certain you keep Austin weird.
So, obviously a big change for you.
Yeah, very change. I moved down middle of my eighth grade year, down to Texas, down to Amarillo, Texas, in the middle of the panhandle, in the middle of nowhere, just on the outskirts of Tornado Alley, where every other Friday we would have a tornado warning, all the sirens, testing everything to make certain that everyone knew that if that you heard that sound not on Friday at noon, that it was a tornado and you need to get shelter. I left the Mormon bubble where I spent most of my life in Salt Lake and went out of Texas, and from an LDS perspective, lived in two different wards and really struggled to try and make friends in those wards. These are people who would known each other their entire lives, had never moved, and they'd grown up together, and here I was, the new kid, trying to fit in and trying to find a place. And it was hard. And I spent a year in one ward, and then we moved within the city and moved into a different ward. And so not only did I try to make friends, I had to try and make new friends in a ward twice. But it was very difficult because I was around the same time I started questioning myself a little bit sexuality, and so that just sort of compounded the fact that I felt alienated and didn't have friends and was trying to figure everything out.
So you were coming to terms with your sexuality around that time, and that's something that maybe we should talk about, is when did you first start realizing that you were different or you had a different sexual orientation?
In hindsight, that definitely came about later in life. But I really started to really question things first year at BYU, and then I really came out of myself about a year later. But we'll get to that.
Okay.
After spending a few years in Texas, I ended up going back to Utah.
Okay.
And finished my last year of high school in Utah. And with a lot of the same friends that I had made growing up, went to the same high school I was supposed to from the beginning, and then went off to BYU for a year. And it was at BYU my freshman year, and I sort of started to realize that things were different, that something wasn't quite right with me. I wasn't really attracted to women all that much, but I didn't vocalize that. I didn't say anything about that. It was more just like, I don't see what the big deal is. Meanwhile, like, I saw attractive guys everywhere. I'm like, oh, yeah, like, he's really great. I want to emulate him. But I really started to figure that out a little bit. And I ended up, after just a whole year at BYU, going in and talking with my bishop of my singles ward there.
David, what year was this when you started at BYU?
I started at BYU in 2006, and I approached my bishop in 2007.
Okay.
But let me back up a little bit. I had been writing a couple of my missionary friends, and I was sitting in my home ward in Salt Lake one day, and I was sitting there writing my friends about how I decided to go on a mission and how I really wanted to sort of be out there and join them in the field. And I realized, and I sort of had this moment as I'm sitting there in the pews on the left-hand side, I just feel all of a sudden like everyone in the chapel is really feeling the fear right now, and I'm not. And in fact, what I felt at that point, I wrote down and described as a cold foreign chill. And that kind of freaked me out. It freaked me out that while I could recognize everyone else was really feeling the dirt, to me, the same feeling felt cold and foreign. And it just iced my entire being. And I'm like, what's wrong? Like, something has to be wrong here. This isn't right. Something's up. And so that was sort of the impetus for going and talking to my bishop.
Okay.
I called my bishop up and set up an appointment for that very evening and said, I need to come in and talk to you. I need to sort of figure some stuff out. And I went in and talked to him and, like, told him, this is how I'm feeling, and I think, I don't know, I'm going through all this stuff with these guys, and something's just not right. And Bishop put his hand on my knee, and he looked at me and went, just want you to know, you're not gay. And then after our session, he went and talked with my state president, and then he talked with his bishop and his state president. And I talked with his former student, who was the head of BYU counseling, and told them all, like, I have this troubled kid who might be gay, who, like, was trying to figure this out, like, what should I do? And it came back down about a week or later when I met with him again, sort of follow-up, that it would be better if this were handled not at BYU. And if I finished up my education not at BYU.
Really?
They were going to allow me to finish out the semester, which was all of a week or two. It was right around final time. But I would not be allowed to re-enroll in classes. That the ecclesiastical endorsement was going to be pulled. And if I wanted to come back to BYU, I could try it in 3 years.
So, wow. That was really a consistent policy up until, you know, a few years later when they began to change the honor code, that you could not self-identify as gay and attend BYU.
Correct. And in fact, I feel like had I pushed back on them a little bit, I could have probably been okay just given the timing, because this was the end of summer semester in 2007. And the policy got changed a few months later is when
okay.
they sort of stopped enforcing this policy.
So what is it a matter of semantics too? Like, so if prior to 2007 at BYU, if you said, hey, I think I may be struggling with same gender attraction, would they still kick you out of BYU for that? I mean, is there a distinction between...
No, I actually don't know. I didn't know the term struggling with same gender attraction was a thing. I didn't understand that term at all. I was trying to just sort of figure out myself, and I'm like, why is it that I'm really attracted to and surrounding myself with all these guys? Like, I'm not really attracted to girls. Something like this can't be right. Something's going to be up. Bishop, help me. And can be, well, that's great and all, but you can't be here. Hear this out.
You didn't even really identify yourself in a certain way. You just said, hey, I'm experiencing these feelings. And he basically said, hey, regardless of that, we can't have you here.
Yeah. At the time, I was looking at pornography as well. So, I mean, I think that might have had some aspect to deal with that. But given the fact that people at NYU look at porn and aren't asked to leave right off the bat, like there's usually probationary time and there's different things in place, I feel like because I'm just like, this is what's going on, that he felt the need to. And also, he felt the need to escalate this severely. It escalated outside the normal chain of ecclesiastical command. It should have gone from my bishop to my state president and stopped there. It should not have gone to his bishop and his state president and his former state president, who was the head of BYU Council. Like, I feel like that shouldn't have necessarily happened, but all of those sort of factors combined. And it came back down to me that we feel it would be best if you dealt with this issue, not at BYU.
Okay. So, and I'm assuming that the pornography situation, was that gay pornography?
It was. I mean, like, it was everything at that time. Like, it was just whatever I could get my hands on. But it tended towards more male gay pornography.
Male pornography, right.
Yeah.
You think that that was probably a factor... Well, the fact that you were having the attractions, the fact that you were engaged in pornography, and then it just kind of spread to all these different people and BYU counseling and other stake presidents, and then the word came back to you, you need to leave. You're better off handling this somewhere else.
And the only reason that it came down where it's able to finish out the semester, and they told me this, was because you came to us, David, and told us this, then, like, we'll let you finish out the semester. If you hadn't have told us this, we wouldn't have been as lenient.
Meaning that if they had discovered it and you had not voluntarily confessed, you would have been kicked out immediately, but because you had voluntarily confessed, they were going to give you the opportunity to finish out your semester at BYU.
Yeah, which was all of a week and a half.
Okay.
They gave me enough time to pack up my office, basically.
Okay. So what are your feelings at that point? I'm assuming your plan was to, you know, always be at BYU and stay at BYU and graduate from BYU. Was that the case?
Well, my plan, actually, like, BYU was my backup school. My original plan was to go to the Air Force Academy.
Oh, okay.
But that ended up, through what I believe is providence, not happening. So BYU is my backup school. And I went to BYU, and was still trying to, like, figure everything out about what I want to do with my life. Because for the longest time, I won't. Air Force, I wanted to be an Air Force pilot, I wanted to be doing Air Force intelligence, and that had been like tantamount to my life for several years, and then didn't end up going to the academy. And so I was trying to figure what degree I wanted to graduate in and all that, so it wasn't that big of a disruption there in terms of, oh my word, my dreams are crushed. That had sort of already happened, and I was trying to figure out what my next thing was when I was at BYU. And I hadn't really gotten to that point, so it wasn't that terrible from, like, a long-term career perspective or from a dreams perspective. It was in that I then had to start telling everyone, oh, why aren't you at BYU anymore? Why did you transfer to the University of Utah? And I had to start coming up with things because I wasn't going to tell them that I was dealing with this. I didn't even have a word for that I was, like, trying to take care of, and so I started telling people I had a medical issue and I needed to be close to the doctors at the U, which to an extent was true. There was some medical stuff going on, but not anything that would force me to move 45 minutes closer to the University of Utah. I ended up telling my dad half of the story, my mom the other half of the story, knowing that they wouldn't talk to each other and put it all together. But I really sort of at that point started going back to my old home ward where I had grown up, where neither my mom nor my dad actually lived in, or it was just the ward I had grown up in. And I started going to the University of Utah and really starting to sort of figure everything out. But I really worked and spent the next year working with my bishop almost every single week, him or my state president, and really trying to figure everything out.
So you end up going back to your home ward in Salt Lake City. People are wondering, hey, why did you leave BYU? Why are you now coming to the University of Utah? And the narrative that you choose to use to kind of protect yourself is for medical reasons, and which you were having some medical issues and to be close to the doctor, although that is not obviously the most compelling reason of why you're now going to the U of U. So you're back in your home ward, and you now have a new bishop in your old home ward. Your parents, of course, are no longer there. How do you tell him about what's going on here with you? What is that conversation like?
Yeah, my BYU bishop told my home ward bishop everything and sort of took care of that for me, unthankfully. He also messed up and called the wrong ward the first time. But that's sort of beside the point. So my bishop had already sort of been aware when I went in and sat down and talked with him. He set up a meeting with me and my stake president. At that point, I had been ordained an elder in the Melchizedek priesthood, but I didn't serve a mission. And so I sat down and I tell my stake president, like, all this stuff is going on. I'm trying to figure things out. Like, I need help. And so weekly sessions with my bishop, about an hour after church, started going to a couple of counselors, trying to sort of figure everything out. Something clearly is not right. But at the same time, in my brain, like, one of the great aspects is that I still didn't feel the spirit, still that cold form chill. And it got to the point where I had cleaned up all the pornography issues and I stopped doing anything along that sort, anything impure there, and was really just trying to focus on everything. And at that point, while at the GU, I had found political science, and I started and signed up to do an internship out here in D.C. And so I flew out to D.C., which happened to be exactly 1 year to the day that I had told my bishop that I started thinking. I'm like, okay, it's been a year. What in the past year has changed? What has happened? Where have I come from? Let's get a situation report. Let's get a status update. And it's on this flight that I start going through. I'm like, okay, like, any behavioral stuff is taken care of. Spiritually, I still feel this cold, foreign chill. And I don't like that. Why? Why am I feeling this? I shouldn't be feeling this, right? Like, this shouldn't be a thing. And I start, like, cycling in my mind, like, well, what if it's this? Like, what if, like, this is just the way you feel the spirit? Or what if this is just not the right time? Or what if, and it came to me and the thought said, well, what if you're gay? And all of a sudden, everything clicked. Everything from, like, what I've been doing at BYU to, like, why I'm sort of attracted to guys to why different things had happened throughout my life when I was, like, 6 and 7 and 9 and 12 and 14. As if, okay, this is the explanation that fits. I'm gay. And I really had this sort of this aha moment of, like, okay, something here, I understand it. Get my head around it. Oh shit, I'm Mormon. And I then had this almost moment of panic on the plane, like, what do I do? How do I reconcile this? How do I deal with this? But I said, I don't care. I'm going to go and I'm going to do and I'm going to do what the Lord commanded. I'm going to fix this because I can do it. And so I got off the plane and started up my internship and started really trying to learn everything I could about sexuality and the scriptures and homosexuality in the Bible and, like, what everything was, so I could try and figure this out. And I started the interview in D.C. and started going to church regularly here. And one of the other guys in the internship, I quickly ended up being gay, and his dad was a bishop in Provo or Oro. And so, like, I came out to him, and I told him, I think I'm gay.
So you knew that he was gay first before you came out to him?
Correct.
Okay.
I sort of figured he was gay, and I trusted that enough that, hey, I'm gay. I kind of need some help here.
Okay.
Like, what do I do? Where do I go? What path do I take? What is that I should do? And he sort of helped a little bit with that. But he very much was at a point in his life where the church didn't hold much meaning for him in his life. And for me, it did. And it's kind of interesting and sort of why. I had never really had a testimony up to this point of the gospel. Like, not for myself. Anything I had was from my parents. It was just sort of borrowed testimony. And I really looked at that as like, okay, why is that? Why is it that this is happening? And why is it that I'm going through this? And even from a religious standpoint, like, do I even believe in the church right now? Like, is it true? I mean, all I know is because of what my parents told me, and we never thought I'd be gay, so maybe that's wrong. And so I really started questioning not only, like, how do I make this work within the church, but is the church even true? And so I would go to my internship. I'd leave about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock every day. I'd come back to the apartment, and I would just read. I would study scriptures. I would study any book I could get my hands on about sexuality and religion and faith. I started piecing together key words in Greek and Hebrew so I could understand how the original New Testament and Old Testament were written, and sort of trying to piece together the linguistics behind sort of the word choice, and maybe something had been mistranslated because, you know, the Bible is only true as far as it's been translated correctly, so maybe it wasn't translated correctly.
Sure.
And I start really trying to piece all of these together and try to find a solution. I start struggling, and I start oscillating back and forth between, well, the church is true, and I just need to not be gay. I just need to be celibate, or maybe I'll find a woman someday. To, well, no, the church is wrong, and I should just go and be gay and leave the church behind. Because what has it done for me?
Are you out to your parents at this point? Have you come out to them and talked about what's going on with you?
I had not told them at all. In fact, I told my mom one half of the story and my dad the other half of the story. They contradicted each other. I knew that if they talked to each other, then the gig would be up, but that they wouldn't. And they have no clue what's going on.
Okay.
They just think, oh, great, David has spent, like, left BYU a year ago, was going through the rough patch, but was at the U now, and he's doing all right, and he's doing well enough that he's doing this internship. His brother did the same internship before, so they have no clue that things are going wrong at all.
Okay, they think everything's actually going okay.
Yeah, I think my mom can sort of sense something when she's on the phone with me, that she knows something's up, but she has no clue sort of what it is. I've not talked to them at this point.
And you've got older siblings, 2 brothers and a sister, is that right?
Correct.
And do they know anything about
no.
orientation?
At this point, the only person that knows is my friend that was at my internship.
Gotcha.
And that was it.
Gotcha. Okay. So you open up to your friend who is gay, his father's a bishop, and he himself is not very active in church or really too interested in church. And you're kind of struggling. You're almost going through a faith crisis, wondering how to reconcile your orientation. Do you really have a testimony? You're digging into the scriptures. You're digging into books about sexuality and orientation. You're digging into translation of the Bible, trying to get context. And where do you go from there?
And so from there, like, I start oscillating between, oh, the church is absolutely 100% true, to the church is absolutely 100% wrong. And from, oh, I need to be celibate or find a wife, to, no, I just need to find a boyfriend. And, like, I start oscillating between the two. And I start struggling to figure things out. And at this point, all this is on the backdrop. Like, I'm going through this faith crisis. I don't have my own testimony at all. I'm also trying to figure that out as well. When I was working, I worked downtown in D.C., about two blocks away from the National Portrait Gallery and the American Art Museum. And just about every day for lunch, I would go up, walk two blocks, grab a bite to eat, and then spend the next 30, 40 minutes of my lunch walking around the gallery and just sort of taking in the sights and just thinking to myself. And I'm going through, and I've been there like 20, 30 times at this point. And I turn the corner, see a portrait of Joseph Smith, just sort of staring up at me. And I'm like, what is that doing here? As I'm like sitting there to clear my head about what I feel about my sexuality and my faith, and do I even have a testimony? And I see the portrait of Joseph Smith outside the context of church, just sort of confronting me. And I go up and I just sort of stare and look at it. And I think, I'm just like, how at 14 years old did you know? How were you able to have answers at 14 years old about what church joined? None of them were right. And here I am, I'm 18, I'm trying to figure things out, and I'm lost. Like, why haven't I gotten it? Why don't I even know that the church is true? Why? And so I went off into a little side room, and they had a bench in the middle of the room. Little circular bench, and I knelt down on it, and I prayed what I thought would be my last prayer, and said,
"Your last prayer, meaning what?"
I sat down and I prayed, and I said, "God, if you even exist, that's when I need to hear you."
When you say your last prayer, what you're saying is, this is almost, I'm laying it on the line here. This is going to be perhaps my last attempt to reach out to God, to try to gain a testimony. And you are at that moment, spiritually kind of putting it all on the line there. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I go with what I think might be this last prayer, this last moment of restoring any faith. And I sit down and I pray, I kneel down and I pray and say, God, if you even exist, now is when I need to know. Because how is it that Joseph Smith knows and I'm sitting here struggling with all of this and have no clue? And it was in that moment that I had the most profound spiritual experience of my life. In that moment that cold, foreign chill was completely replaced, and I felt an undeniable warmth, like sunlight was dancing all around. Like my spirit had been homesick and I didn't know it, and all of a sudden I was home. I felt the spirit so strongly and so powerfully that I mark it and chalk it up to sort of spiritual revelation that and personal revelation, and I was told, and I felt them, that God does exist, that Jesus Christ lived, and that he died for my sins. And that Joseph Smith did kneel down and pray in the garden, did receive the Book of Mormon, and did translate it. And that became my testimony. Like, that was so powerful. I ended up getting up, and I literally was skipping down the street, thinking in my head, oh, that I were an angel, that I could tell the world.
What you just experienced.
I wanted to shout this from the rooftops of what I just experienced.
Yeah.
I went into work after lunch, and my coworkers were like, David, you look so great. What happened? I'm like, I just got some good news. And, like, it was so powerful.
Just.
And so profound.
I mean, this is really, this is a pivotal moment in your life where you gain a testimony. I just think it's so interesting, just on a spiritual level, on a, just a level of beauty, really, that you walk in, you unexpectedly see this portrait of Joseph Smith. And I think it's interesting in our faith tradition, how we talk about the Sacred Grove experience, and how, you know, in the song, Joseph Smith's first prayer, and we talk about it being his first uttered prayer. And yet here, in juxtaposition, as you see his portrait, you are saying, this is my last prayer, potentially. So it's his first prayer. It's your last prayer. These are coming into interaction, conjunction, juxtaposition. You offer up a very sincere prayer, and you feel Heavenly Father reaching out to you. You're filled with love. You're filled with light. And you almost have, in some ways, a kind of how I see Joseph Smith coming out of the grove. You know, he's coming out there. He's excited. He's, you know, you're probably too young to remember the old movie of Joseph Smith. But, you know, for us 40-year-olds and older, you know, you just see him running out of the grove and, you know, just wanting to just be able to tell people, wow, what an incredible experience. And you're kind of the same way. They see you at work and they notice that you're different in some way. And what do you say to them?
I just sort of pass it off. I mean, I've known these people for a month and a half. I just sort of shrug it off, and I'm just inside, so like glowing and trying to figure out then at this point, when I sort of came back down a couple hours later, was, okay, now what do I do from here? Now one piece is sick. Now this faith crisis is, I know that the gospel is true. But how does that impact everything else? How does knowing that the gospel is true affect everything else? How does that affect my choices? How does it affect what I do in life? How does that affect my sexuality and spirituality?
Okay.
And this actually, contrary to what I would have hoped it did, it increased the cycle of oscillation where I kept going back and forth between the two. Because now, whereas before, it's like, well, maybe the church isn't even true, like, and favoring on the scales of spirituality and sexuality was facing a losing battle because I didn't have a strong testimony. Now there's a stronger testimony, and so, but it was still more equally weighed now. It's like, which one is right? Which one do I do? And I started going through, and instead of trying to figure it out logically, I started like really trying, like, what is truth? What is the right thing for me to do here? Because my testimony didn't tell me that. It just told me that the gospel is true.
So in some ways, it almost created more conflict for you.
Not in some ways. It absolutely created more conflict.
Okay. So,
it absolutely did. It created more conflict to the point where it drove me from skipping down the street in this, oh, that I were an angel, into a depression state where I was trying to figure out which was right, and now they're far more balanced than ever before. That I felt that I had to kill off half of who I was so the other half could live. Because of this testimony that I had gained, now the two sides of the struggle were equally balanced. And they're equally balanced and diametrically opposed. There's the sword told in LDS circles, and it's a Native American tale. I think it's Navajo or Hopi. And it tells the story of two wolves, that inside every one of us, there are two wolves, a good wolf and a bad wolf. And they are constantly fighting each other. And whichever wolf wins is the wolf that you feed. And I really sort of took that and sort of really like experiencing that anytime I thought about one thing, the other would start losing. And I felt this tearing inside of me that half of who I was had to be killed off. And it was terrible. It was an absolutely terrible feeling.
Because you identified the good wolf with the church, with the testimony you received, the spiritual experience, and the bad wolf, the evil wolf, you identified as being gay.
No, not really. In fact, that sort of infantilizes the point that
okay.
I thought that each side was equally good and equally bad. That each side was who I was a core part of my identity. It wasn't like, oh, I need to do this, I need to do good, I don't need to sin. It was, David is Mormon, and David is gay, and both of these things are who I am. But in order to do what people tell me is right, what people tell me is the good wolf, I have to kill off this, what they tell me is the bad wolf. But I don't feel like it's a bad wolf. It's who I am.
So you really resisted the homophobic notion that the gay part of you, who you are as a gay man, is bad and evil. You really rejected that, pushed back against that, even though other people were telling you, hey, that's kind of the bad part of you. You pushed back against that.
Yeah. I knew from studying, from talking to my bishop for over a year, that like that part was bad, and that's what they were telling me. But I, like I said when I was offline, I had this aha moment, like, oh, okay, I'm gay. This all makes sense now. And it wasn't until I added in the conflict of, and I'm Mormon.
Gotcha.
Until those two were in the same sentence together, gay didn't mean evil in my mind at that point.
Okay.
And so at this point, I'm going back and forth on a weekly basis between, oh, I just need to leave the church and never back, to I just need to not be gay. I'm going to white knuckle this. I beat it. And at this point, my dad came out to D.C. He was out here for work and spent a couple of days with me. And I sat down and talked to him and had a conversation with him and told him that I was gay.
How did you decide to do that? Go through kind of how you, was this really a scary thing for you to be able to tell your dad? How did you decide to tell your dad?
Well, I spent a couple of days with him, and it was towards the end, and he could clearly see that I was miserable and depressed and distraught, and he had an idea of what was going on, and so he opened up the door a little bit, and...
Oh, so he perhaps sensed that you had a different sexual orientation. Is that what you're saying?
At this point, yes, he definitely did. He didn't say that to me, but he was prompting me to come out of that. And he realized this because when he got remarried, his stepson had already come out before he got married into the family. And after he got married into the family, one of his stepdaughters came out. So
really, okay, so he really had lived experience with, in this case, having stepchildren who were gay and came out.
Correct. And at one point, my stepbrother had asked my mom, like, "Do you think David's gay?" Neither of them had told me this at this point, but my stepmom told my dad. And so when I'm out here going through all of this difficulty, my dad puts two and two together. Wait, it's not BYU. Puts it all sort of together and sort of prompts me, like, "David, you know that I love you no matter what, really, no matter what." And I'm like, "Well, what if I'm gay?" And he's like, "Love is the same." And we had a good conversation around that. And he and I bonded and really had a good moment there, which we didn't have a strong relationship to begin with. And that was really helped beneficial. But okay, I had finally told someone else. I had finally come out to someone else, and they knew now. But it didn't help. I still started going through this depression, still trying to fix things. My dad said, "Well, David, maybe the church isn't right for you. Maybe you need to, like, maybe you do need to find someone you can care and love about. But don't leave sort of the morals that you've gained from the church and your standards and throw them aside." And that was his damage. And so I took that in, and that was another thing that started going through my brain. And I spent the next 4 weeks really going through this same process over again in my mind, like, gay or church, gay or church, spirituality or sexuality. Which side of me am I going to choose to let live? And which side am I going to have to kill off? At this point, this was 2008. My mom came out to D.C. and New York, and we spent a couple of days together. And we were in New York on election night, 2008. And we were coming back. She and I went and saw Wicked on election night, and then we walked back to the hotel room. And I sat there nervously watching the election results in California. We had presidential came on the TV, and I'm sitting there just refreshing election results in California, wanting to know what Prop 8 results were. And it was, I'm like, all right, she could see something was going on. And it was a couple of days later, just before she was about to leave and go back home to Salt Lake, that I came out to her. And that was a very different experience. When I came out to her, she took it very differently from my dad. She started out in silence for what felt like to me 45 solid minutes of silence. Realistically, it was probably 5 or 10, but silence.
5 or 10 minutes of silence that's a long time.
Profound. And after the silence, she said, "David, I believe that you think that you might possibly, maybe, be gay." With no less than 5 qualifiers in that sentence. And really, I had to then tell her, like, "No, Mom, I know. I absolutely know that this is true. This is not just some phase. This is not me rebelling. This is not me being a teenager. This is part of who I am." And she didn't take it all that well. The next day, she was like, "All right, I want you to know that I love you." In that moment, she didn't take it all that well. Since, she's come around fantastically, but at that point, not the best.
When you say she did not take it all that well, can you give our listeners a little bit more detail about what you mean by that? I mean, obviously, silence. Then there's almost kind of a sense of denial because there's so many qualifiers in her recognizing your orientation or lack of recognition, and then you being certain. Were there other ways in which she did not take it well? Did she get emotional?
She's always one to sort of hold back on the emotions a little bit in the initial round.
Okay.
Like she and I are both similar like that, where when we're initially confronted with something, we'll take it before the emotions come in. And she was processing things.
Okay, so you're both kind of a little bit more stoic in situations like that.
Yeah, myself a lot more than her, a lot more than average. So
I got another question. So with your dad, he's very accepting and open, and even going so far as to say, "Hey, maybe the church is not maybe perhaps quite the best thing for you." And then your mom, you know, not taking it in comparison nearly as well. Did this surprise you? I mean, you know your father and your mother better than I do. Did it surprise you their reactions to you? Were you surprised that your dad was so affirming and open? And did it surprise you that your mom really, really struggled with it?
I wasn't too surprised. Largely because my dad has always been dealing with his own faith crisis, and has always, and even now, is very inactive in the church. And that was part of the contention that my parents faced during their divorce. And so, like, that wasn't as surprising to me. And my mom, being a convert,
okay,
was very much more inclined to rely on the church.
Okay.
So it wasn't that surprising to me. Surprising to me was that it's my mom, and she had this moment. But at the same time, it went better than I feared it could. In the movie Latter Days, there's a scene where the missionary is coming out to his mom, or telling his mom that maybe it's not what I've done, maybe it's who I am. Maybe I am gay, and maybe it's a part of who I am. And she slaps him across the face and says, "Don't you dare say that. Because what you've done, that can be forgiven. But who you are, that can't be." And I really feared that that would be how my mom reacted. Not physically slapping me, but that same passionate response, I really feared. And so it was much more difficult for me to tell my mom than it was to tell my dad.
Okay, that makes sense. And so you had seen this movie prior to you coming out to your mom, and you were worried that she was going to have a really, really strong response, but it wasn't the best response, but it wasn't quite as bad as the movie that you saw.
Correct. It was not as bad. And I was grateful for that. I built it up as this could be a very bad thing, but the next day my mom and I had another good long discussion. She went off back home to Salt Lake, and I kept here at DC and kept trying to figure things out, and kept really trying to put everything in its right place. And from that point until about a week before Thanksgiving, so the next 3 weeks, the oscillation from every week to every other day, I'd be in my mind going, "No, this is right. No, this is right. No, this is right. No, this is right." And each day it felt like one side of who I was trying to get rid of the other. I was sort of abdicating the choice of which side of me had to die. And at this point, I was reading the book In Quiet Desperation by Ty Mansfield and by Southern Sister Mattis. And there's a part in there that I read that they were quoting Marion Giomney about coming home from a mission, that it's better that you come home in a box than come home dishonorably. And it was at this point that in the book that Sister Mattis is talking about how, while she's very saddened that her son took his life, that she was glad he had never broken his covenant.
So just to give our listeners a little bit of background, you're referring to the parents of Stuart Mattis, right?
Correct.
And he is known as a gay man, Mormon, who ended up taking his life. I believe he was in Southern California. Is that right?
He was in California. I don't know if Southern or Northern, but yeah.
Yeah, and ended up taking his life, if I'm not mistaken, outside his ward building or the stake center.
And this was then, he did that during Proposition 22, which was the precursor to Proposition 8.
Yeah, that was part of the issue that was an ingredient into the scenario. And he ended up taking his life. And so you're reading about the perspective of his parents now in this book.
Correct. And his parents are, his mom is talking about how, that while dad and her son took his life, she's grateful that he didn't break his covenant. And that reminded me of the Marion Giomney quote, that it's better to come home in a box than come home dishonorably. And I got to the point where I wanted to know which side was right in this fight between the two of them. And I wanted to know, and I didn't want to come home to God dishonorably. And I did not want to break my covenants with God. And I realized that in this struggle of which side was right, which side of me had to live and the other had to die, and that I had to decide and kill off half of who I was, and I wasn't positive which half was right. And the answer was I wouldn't decide. I let God choose. And that if I took my life, then I'd finally know. That if I ended my life, then it would be God's choice to choose which side of me needed to live and which side of me needed to die. And at that point, I started taking some pills that I had. And I started taking more and more pills and just kept going. I called my mom at this point after I'd taken the first couple of pills and wanted to talk with her. And she wasn't there. And she'd gotten to bed early, and so I left the voicemail. And told her, Mom, I really want to talk to you. Please give me a call back. And if you don't hear from me, it's not your fault. And then I kept taking more pills. And at this point, I'm trying to talk with someone, and I end up calling four gay Mormons that I had met online through one of the various blogs, and told them this was going on, and I was not doing too well. And he started trying to get my address so he could send an ambulance. And really started to try and help. And I'm like, no, no, you can send a birthday card. You want to get my address, you can send an ambulance. And he kept me on the phone talking long enough that when my roommate came in into the room, he realized something was gone and took the phone from me and tried to figure out what was going on and realized what was happening and called 911.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Clayton Pixton. Check him out at claytonpixton.com. How kind his precepts are. Come cast your burdens on the Lord and trust his constant
I'll drop my burden.